Story 12. The Once Angry Minister.
What are we to do with this enhanced story of ourselves? Can what we do really be in alignment that deeply with who we are? I think it can if we let "I'm going to be truer to myself" be the principle that drives our decisions every time we come to a crossroads. Through trial and error, we are pushed to greater recognition about what we really need. The big, bold step turns out to be only the first step. No story demonstrates this more cleanly than John Butler's. The first time we talked, John was in his law office in Santa Clara. He's about 6'1", with ruddy cheeks and short auburn hair and a diamond stud in his left ear. He still had the sweeping shoulders and tapered hips that he developed almost 30 years earlier when he was ranked number 2 nationally in the 200-meter breaststroke. He's 47 now. John was preparing to shut down his divorce mediation practice so that he might become ordained as a minister by the Unity Church. This was a 2-year program at Unity's world headquarters in Missouri. John expected to hear any day, and did, the next day, by letter. His application was turned down. The church told him he had anger issues. John had spent his entire life struggling to overcome his anger. He thought he had overcome it. So this rejection was doubly devastating. It almost extinguished his hopes. The next time we talked in depth, we met in the Portland, Oregon airport and traveled down to the southwest corner of the state to a 2-stoplight town called Bandon by the Sea. The Unity chapter in Bandon had given John a 6-month contract as their interim minister, even though he was not ordained. Their regular minister was on sabbatical. John was 2 months into his contract. He'd come back to the Bay Area that week for training, and he absolutely loved his new work. It had convinced him his instincts had been right. "Already I can't imagine not being a minister. I'm not even sure I can go into the ministry training program next year. Why wait 2 years to do something I've already gotten to do and am good at?" While this jump from lawyer to minister sounds like one of those radical 90-degree turns, John's been narrowing in on this his whole adult life. And the theme that's brought him here has been consistent. When he was young, he was abrasive and quick to assign blame, and he found work that aligned with that personality. But his life has been a gradual step-by-step away from that hostility. This latest step has brought him to the other end of the spectrum. Now he's calm, good-natured, and forgiving. That journey began shortly after college. He had a personal motive for becoming a lawyer. He'd suffered a great injustice in court. John had started out as a carpet salesman for a building materials wholesaler. They stiffed him on $80,000 in commissions, so he sued. John hired a letterhead litigator from one of San Jose's best firms to represent him, but the guy did a lousy job and was unprepared. John thought, "If this guy is supposedly the best, I'm in the wrong business." He took the LSATs a week later, paid the extra $100 to be FedExed his score quickly, and persuaded Santa Clara's law school to take him at the last minute. He was sitting in property class a week later. He flashed that same kind of bullheadedness after school when he joined the San Jose District Attorney's office. Within a year, he was the lead misdemeanor attorney in the office. His specialty was drunk driving arrests. John went after everyone. He refused to settle. He was feverish with his righteousness. These people had done something wrong. They had to be punished. If that meant he had to work 90-hour weeks, he would do it. If it meant he tied up the courtrooms, so be it. There was no excuse for letting offenders plead to a second or third offense as if it were their first offense. There was no excuse for not making them go to AA meetings and fulfill their community service. John became infamous in Santa Clara County courts, and soon no attorney wanted to take him on. They began to plead guilty without a trial. A couple of things ended this vindictiveness. First, John realized how much of the anger he had for drunk drivers was actually misdirected rage at his father, who drank excessively when John was young. As soon as he made the connection, he no longer felt this hatred for the offenders. His zeal for prosecuting these cases was suddenly gone. The district attorney bumped him up to felonies, and his first two cases were ones that the DA wanted to drop because they were too hard to prosecute. But John couldn't do that. When he saw blame, he would stop at nothing to get a conviction. One was a molestation case involving a patient at a mental institution, the other a child endangerment case. He took both cases to trial and won convictions, but they required an incredible amount of his energy. He could see that if he were to prosecute rapists and murderers, he would never escape from this cycle. His tendency to take these cases so personally, as if he were the victim, meant the cases would swallow him. He needed to learn not to take it so personally, something he would never do if assigned to criminal cases. So he quit and spent 3 months soul-searching. He thought about being a minister, but it was so far-fetched, it was like a football player suggesting he wants to be a ballerina, John said. John decided to go into bankruptcy law. He got 2 job offers from firms that specialized in corporate bankruptcy. The first was from a hardball litigation firm that took everything to court. The second was less prestigious and less money, but from a boutique that preferred to negotiate, use workout sessions, and help the debtor's business turn around. John had a deep hatred of debtors. His wound from that $80,000 in unpaid commissions hadn't healed at all. But this second firm's approach tugged at him. John went with them. It felt right. He found in their methods a better solution for his own resentments, which he had held against his parents and his ex-wife. He spent 4 years there, then started his own practice. It was yet another notch down in pay and prestige, but he thought he'd be happier representing consumers rather than corporations. Consumer bankruptcies were usually uncontested. The injured parties were banks and credit companies who didn't take it personally. The whole process was designed to help a man turn his life around. Again, this felt right. John was very good at it, and highly sought after. He was also in therapy at this time, and he was realizing how much better he felt talking things out than bearing grudges and fighting endlessly. One day after therapy, as he was sitting in the parking lot, the thought occurred to him, "Why don't you become a mediator?" John took a class on mediation with the goal of doing one divorce mediation by the end of the year. John became rather quickly the dominant and most successful divorce mediator in Silicon Valley. John had been married for 6 years, had 2 children, and divorced during law school. He brought these experiences to his mediation sessions, and he was often in tears as he described his own experiences to the warring parties. He utilized men are from Mars, women are from Venus techniques to help divorcees communicate better in their sessions. John found the work very rewarding and still does. But one of the keys to resolving marital separation agreements is always to push the question, what do you really want? She doesn't really want the car. She wants him to say he's sorry and to admit he handled it badly. He doesn't really want the home. He wants her to forgive him. And John Butler really wanted to be a minister. The thing was, he didn't go to church and he didn't really believe. But he still wanted to be a minister. Somehow it called to him quietly. It didn't make sense, but the idea of ministering to people's problems seemed the next step in his evolution. During this time, John took a theology class at San Jose State. It was very academic and not very spiritual. He looked into seminaries, but he didn't believe in any of those religions. Then he met a woman who was a minister, and he fell in love with her, and started going to her church, and they got engaged. John thought she was his soulmate. She was going to make this transition easy for him. Their plan was, after the marriage, John would become the co-minister of her church. He still hadn't found his belief yet, but the God part wasn't the appeal to him. Shortly before the wedding, She called it off and broke up with him. No soulmate, no ministry, no church. I see now that I was using her to make my dream happen, John said, and there was something false in that. I wasn't willing to do the work myself. It was devastating, but it was a real test. Was I willing to make the transition alone, without anybody's help? That's a lot scarier. John went looking for a new church. He tried the Unity Church in Palo Alto, and more for ritual and solace than religion, he kept going back. The Unity Church did not convert him, not in the slightest. Slowly, gradually, as he learned more about Unity's teachings, he realized here was a church that he didn't disagree with or have misgivings about. Here was a church that aligned with how he'd come to see the world. One of the distinguishing beliefs of Unity is that the world is not a battle between good and evil. There are not good people and bad people, the right and the wrong, the saved and the damned. Unity teaches that all people are inherently good, even if they might have made some mistakes. This is exactly what John had slowly gravitated to in his work. Then, Unity teaches practical Christianity, meaning it models how to handle life's everyday difficult situations, which are their own reward when handled well. Unity ministers don't wear robes and aren't the congregation's conduit to God. John found in the Unity Church a way to add a spiritual dimension to his evolving skills in handling conflict resolution. With everything in alignment, his spiritual belief gradually came to him. But being religious was not enough, John said, and bringing spiritual ideas into my mediation practice was not enough. I still had a calling to be the one delivering the sermon. John joined the board of the church and became a well-regarded mediator for church conflicts, both at his church and at others. It was at one of these mediation sessions, for a Unity chapter in another county, that John learned their minister had to leave town on a family medical emergency. Who was going to deliver Sunday's sermon? I'd love to do the sermon, John found himself saying. He had 3 days to prepare. He'd never felt more alive. His mentor attended, and so did his mother and father. When John talks about his father, his voice trembles and cracks with emotion. After the sermon, he came up to me and blessed me. He choked up, then let go. It was the first time in my life he blessed me. He said I had a gift. Over the next couple years, John delivered an occasional sermon and took some week-long classes at Unity's world headquarters in Missouri. I discovered him through a friend who attends the Unity Church in San Francisco, where John gave 3 sermons last year. When we talked last year, it amazed me that he was once an abrasive man, but he assured me that was the kindest word one might use to describe him. He understood himself enormously well and had nothing to hide. He was never afraid to reveal his weaknesses. I assumed he was going to be accepted to the ministry program. How could he not? He'd clearly done his work. Being told I had anger issues was such a blow, John said now 9 months later. I was infuriated at being rejected. I was angry at them. And yet every time I felt anger, it was like I was offering them evidence that I'm angry. Of course I'm angry because I felt they were wrong, but I couldn't protest or appeal their decision because they would see that state I was in and think they were right about me. It was a trap. How did you get out of it? I asked. Well, first, spending a lot of time forgiving them for what I perceived was their mistake. And then, kind of on the wings of that forgiveness, I realized they were probably right. I had been a little on edge when I went for the week to Unity Village. I don't like being judged and evaluated. And they had these knick-knack rituals that bothered me, sort of treated us like children. There was a dress code, just casual clothes, but I'm an adult, I dress appropriately. Then I had to sign in for classes every morning, as if I might skip class. I'd paid over $1,000 for the plane tickets, hotel room, and rental car. Was I really going to skip class? So these things put me on edge, and they could feel it when I was there. I had a bit of a grudge.
So did you go back after you were turned down for the program?
Yes, I went back for another week to sit in more classes from the very teachers who had denied me permission to the program. That was a real test. It would have been so easy to see them as my enemy, my tormentors, and bear a grudge. When they saw I did not bear this grudge, and I was no longer bothered by the knick-knacks required, they realized I was a better man than they had known. It sounds like you will get admitted to the program next year. Yes, they've indicated that, and I've applied. But I don't think I want to go, he said. Why not? Because I love being a minister so much. I'd rather find another short-term position than sit in school. My contract is up in June. That will be a very tough decision. He told me the story of how he received this position in Bandon, Oregon. When he was back in Missouri, he grabbed a newsletter for Unity Ministers. In the back pages were classified ads from churches needing ministers. Bandon had advertised. John called and sent them a CD of his sermons, but he was told they already had two ordained candidates they were interviewing. A month later, they called back. Neither of the two candidates was quite right. Could John be there in 4 days and deliver the Sunday sermon? He agreed, but then was told they couldn't pay for his plane ticket, which was about $400. John bristled. It was standard procedure to pay for a candidate's travel costs. He didn't want to be taken advantage of. Finally, on a friend's advice, he decided to drive a 12-hour trip, spend the night, give the sermon, and drive back the next day. The congregation loved him. He was offered the 6-month contract. I know it now seems like a dream come true, but it still was very hard for me to accept. Most of my friends and my mentor thought I shouldn't take it. I would have to pay other lawyers to take over my mediation cases and wrap up a practice I'd taken years building for what? For a 6-month gig that led nowhere, that offered no next step, no future. My success is not measurable. I used to make $250 an hour. This job pays $425 a week. It's not like I was unhappy with my mediation cases. I love that work. Plus, I really want to find a soulmate. Most of the people in Bandon are retired and older than I am. He went on with more excuses until I cut him short. But you needed to know if this was really for you, I argued. Yes. Is it? So much more than I ever anticipated. Unity's chapel in Bandon is an aluminum-sided, aluminum-roofed barn across from an oil chain shop off the coast highway. It's a humble place. There's no cross on the roof's peak. Inside, the walls are plastered and the ceilings are suspended and the light flickers from long fluorescent tubes. The floor is covered from wall to wall with cream carpet. There are no pews, just semicircular rows of ordinary metal chairs. I had no expectations, so I wasn't surprised. But now describing it, I'm at a loss. What makes it a church at all? It was entirely in the minds of the congregation. They hadn't inherited a place of worship. They'd started this chapter themselves, and the church required their participation or it would not exist. During the week, there are children's classes, a writer's group, a science of mind class, a meditation class, a prayer support group, and at 9:30 on Sunday mornings, an adult class with about 15 feisty people who wanted John to challenge them. This was incredibly refreshing. Most of them were retired. They'd come to tranquil Bandon from California's busy cities, but they weren't here to golf and play bridge. They'd gone north, not south. In their 50s and 60s, they were using this time for personal growth. John had given them homework the week prior, and most had done the exercises. He'd asked them to write down their limiting beliefs, essentially their opinions of themselves, re-seen not as identity statements, but as self-constraints. One woman's limiting belief her whole life was that she wasn't smart and couldn't learn. She'd realized she did learn, but slowly. Another woman's limiting belief was that she could never ask for help. She had to fix everything and by herself. John urged her to learn the feeling of helplessness. Wow, she exclaimed, unable to imagine ever going there, but willing to think about it. Another woman said that her limiting belief was that there was never enough money. One of the principles of unity is to be aware of our abundance, that we already have plenty and will not go hungry, that the world will take care of us. She had real trouble accepting this, and as a result, she was preoccupied with the material world. I began to get the hang of this exercise, and I wrote down the limiting beliefs that had stopped me over my lifetime. That my dream of writing wouldn't come true, and I needed to find another career. That my divorce had wounded me. That being a parent was not compatible with my calling. That nobody would read what I wrote unless I was funny. Many of the constructs John was teaching these retirees were ones I'd arrived at over the course of writing this book, that our fears should be attacked, not run from. From our deepest wounds come our greatest gifts. Everyone in this program has overcome his or her own limiting beliefs. They've discovered that their hard-earned skills mean more to them than the talents they were born with. John said, "Most of us can trace our problems back to two or three limiting beliefs." In his own case, he had believed he was a fighter, and so he went looking for fights in the swimming pool, in the courts of justice, and in his family. That fighter turned out to be only a shell, and inside was a man who hated to fight. At 11 o'clock, the chapel filled with about 70 people. John took the microphone and led the service. People felt free to interrupt with questions or joke lightly with him. During his sermon, he involved several as actors in a skit. He never bludgeoned them with scripture and quoted poets and philosophers and politicians more than Christ's disciples. In a voice quaking with feeling, he told long stories from his own life, from times when he was challenged to love unconditionally or grant forgiveness. He had told me, "All week long, Sunday's sermon is on my mind. It really pushes me to think and observe. This is not about me lording over the congregation, me being better than them. I've got tons to learn. Delivering a weekly sermon accelerates that growth." John Butler's arc is, in my opinion, the clearest example of how I've come to think the question, "What should I do with my life?" should be approached. What I so admired about John Butler's journey was not that he ended up a minister. Most people jump through life asking what's next and choosing, based on where they can make the most money, what offers the most upside or opportunity. A conventional success story is one where, with each next, the protagonist has more money, more respect, and more possessions. I'd like to suggest an alternative success story, one where, with each next, the protagonist is closer to finding that spot where he's no longer held back by his heart, and he explodes with talent, and his character blossoms, and the gift he has to offer the world is apparent.
Story 13. Accepting a Gift.
I accumulated 100 stories from recent parents, and I could only make one broad observation. Many of our fears and misconceptions about our careers stem from our fears and misconceptions about being a parent. We treat one or the other like a highly explosive liquid compound which we've heard has to be handled gingerly. When it comes time to mix them, we'll do this studiously, in the laboratory, under controlled conditions. We do so deliberately, with a plan. Many of us grew up watching our parents go through a midlife crisis. Our parents jumped into their adulthood quickly, saddling themselves with responsibilities like mortgages and children, and often compromising their dreams to support the family without quite realizing that's what they were doing. Later, they wanted to recapture the youth they'd abandoned too soon. Now it's our turn, and is it any wonder we're wary of taking on responsibilities before we're ready? We're extending our youth, getting married later, and waiting to have children. If we have a midlife crisis, it's the other side of our parents' coin. We realize that endless youth isn't endlessly fulfilling. It gets old. One by one, we add those meaningful responsibilities into the mix. We do this with great ceremony. They've been built up in our minds as threats to our freedom, so to undertake them is now courageous. Even if we get married young or have children young, we usually don't do it blindly. We have pretty strong expectations about the trade-offs we're making, and we have a script for how we're going to manage. We pray we get it right. Despite this careful planning, so many people reported that it did not go according to plan. It was more meaningful than they expected, or less, or more stressful, or less. It was easier to mix these explosive compounds, or harder. What people expected and what they discovered often had no correlation, which suggests that our expectations often do us no good. They get in the way. Our expectations are frequently only veiled versions of our wishes and fears. Becoming a parent can trigger a return of meaning, a sort of meaning audit. The relationship with your child is so meaningful it can reveal just how meaningless other things in your life are. And people deal with this information in opposite ways. Many people suddenly are relieved of the burden of finding meaningful work. They're perfectly content to punch the clock. Family provides meaning now. If they can afford to, they'd rather stay home with the kids. But just as commonly, this meaning audit compels people to hold a higher standard to their life. They can no longer waste half their waking hours on some job that doesn't do it for them. They didn't want their child to watch them lead a dispassionate life. Almost half the people in this program are parents. Kat Clark was one. Kat and I began corresponding as she was facing a very tough decision, whether to give up her dream for her daughter. What was compelling about her story was that this was not the first time. The first time was in the mid-80s. In high school, Kat stood out. She was different. She was not accepted into any clique. She had an outspoken personality, and she was embarrassingly big and strong. 6'2" and bulked up with muscle. The only place in high school that she did not feel weird and out of place, the only place where her size was not socially awkward, was on the track team. She threw the discus 175 feet and the shot put 50 feet, which placed her second in the state of California. Her goal was to compete in the Seoul Olympics in 1988. She was a natural, and she was driven. She took all the rejection and poured her revenge into the weight stacks. During her senior year, she had scholarship offers to attend the best track colleges in the country. But she leveled with herself. She didn't really like school. She didn't feel comfortable at school. So she joined the Marines as an enlisted person. The Marines had a track team that sent its athletes to the Olympic trials. She told her recruiter this was her goal. He promised her that she could join the Camp Pendleton team, and she would do nothing but prepare for the All-Marine team and the Olympic trials. A year later, the All-Marine team was 2 months away from being chosen for the Olympic trials. Kat's distances were certain to qualify her for the team. But then, disturbingly, she lost some of her strength. She couldn't leg press her normal workouts. Her throws fell short. She tried to fight through it, train harder, run 6 miles a day. She started to fear she'd not be selected. She wasn't feeling well and wanted to vomit. At the last minute, she went in for a physical. She was at work on base, waiting for a phone call from her coach to be notified whether she made the team. When the phone rang, instead it was the team doctor. Kat was 8 weeks pregnant. She thought this was impossible because she was on the pill. Being a mom was the last thing on her mind. But the news put the biggest smile on her face. The doctor told her that if she wanted to keep the baby, she would have to give up her training fairly soon. The baby or the Olympic trials. The choice was easy for her. The father was not in the picture. She wanted the baby. A few days later, that other call came. She'd made the All-Marine team. She turned them down. There was no question. Her daughter, Marlena, grew into the most beautiful girl. Kat raised her alone, devoting her life to parenting. She never regretted it and never thought about track again. Kat developed endometriosis and, after 2 miscarriages and 4 laparoscopies, gave up ever having another child. For work, Kat became an executive assistant to various CEOs of Silicon Valley companies. Marlena was the world to her. They're like sisters, telepathic. They could always guess what the other got for Christmas. When one was asked a question, the other one answered. Sometimes they answered together using the same words. They adopted 3 dogs and 3 cats. Every day, Kat would take a break from work at 2:30 to pick her daughter up after school and take her home before returning to work. Marlena's softball and volleyball trophies line the mantel. Her pictures are all over Kat's desk. Despite scoliosis, Marlena batted 306 in softball. She was the third chair flautist in the Bay Area's honor chorus. Fast forward to last year. Kat decided to do something about that college degree she never went for. She enrolled part-time at De Anza Community College, and one day, on a lark, she went down to the track coach's office. She was afraid to knock, so she wrote down his phone number and called him when she got back to her car. She explained her situation and wanted to know if she was still eligible to throw the shot and discus. He looked her up, found her state records, and told her he would absolutely love to have her on the team. She would have to carry a full academic load, though. Part-time students aren't allowed to participate in NCAA athletics. He introduced her to a trainer, who flogged Kat back into shape. After 13 years, Kat had added weight, but at 32 was able to regain all her strength in a few short months. The following semester, she enrolled in 15 units and joined the track team. She was working at her job every day, attending classes 3 nights a week, and working out 5 nights a week. Her form was perfect. Already she was throwing farther than she had at 19. This strength gave her a renewed confidence in herself. I wanted to go to state. I wanted to work towards going to the Olympic trials again in 2004. I wanted to recapture my youth that was taken away when my wonderful daughter was born, Kat wrote me shortly after. It sounded, at the time, like an inspiring story, a woman who waited until her daughter was old enough to regain her dream. When Kat left for work in the morning, Marlena was still asleep. When Kat came home at night, Marlena was going to bed. From her attitude, I knew that she wasn't happy, and yet all I could think about was what made me happy, Kat said. When the semester ended, Kat chose to work nights at a metaphysical bookstore during the Christmas rush. Marlena was an excellent student, but had developed terrible testing anxiety. Her finals would be in early January. She needed her mom to tutor her, but Kat didn't have time. 2 days before Christmas, Marlena confronted her mom. Mom, I am lonely. You are never home anymore. Kat was facing the choice again. Marlena's critique jolted her out of selfish mode, and she now hated herself for having lost touch with the one person who meant more to her than anything. But what to do with this natural talent she clearly had? It was now or never. When the semester resumed, should she go back to the team? Should she continue her classes? She had always wanted to be a high school teacher. Could she pursue that, find another outlet for her desire to transform? She invited me down to talk with her about it, but I was reluctant to be involved in such a crucial decision. I backed off. It echoed times in my life that were shameful to confront, like how selfishly I had handled leaving my wife. When I was 15, my mother gave us up to my father in order to try to become a stockbroker. I never thought of that as selfish. Hell, I made it harder for her. I balked. I refused to move into my dad's home and once ran away to my mom's. I was the selfish one. Was the stress I caused a factor in why she had to go back to being a secretary? I waited 2 months before going to see Kat again. She had dropped the track team and shortly after dropped her classes altogether. She spent her nights going over homework with Marlena. She could feel her strength eroding. Her muscles itched to be used. Occasionally, she resented her sacrifices. They snipped at each other. But then Marlena received her grades, which were excellent. That's when I knew I'd made the right decision, Kat said. My time invested made a difference. Any resentment I had vanished. I commented that it sounded a little too Hallmark. Being a mother makes it all worthwhile. Kat clarified. The most frustrating thing about parenting is not the sacrifices. It's when you try everything and they still won't eat, or they shut you out and won't accept your comfort. You feel helpless. And the opposite is the most fulfilling, when being there for them actually helps. So the fulfillment wasn't in merely being a mother. It was in being a great mother, in spending a lot of time with her daughter and really being aware of what she was thinking and feeling, having that telepathic-like connection again. They went to an NSYNC concert together. One weekend, they went down to Pebble Beach for the pro-am to ogle the celebrities. Kat became girlish around Marlena. It was pretty clear that she was reliving a bit of her lost youth with her daughter, but nothing was wrong with that. Kat never talked about her decision as a sacrifice. She loved spending time with her daughter. It made her happy. Kat also felt a clarity in having a singular purpose. When she could fudge her various responsibilities, the many directions of her ambition tore her apart. When Marlena made the stakes clear, Kat could embrace that one thing and enjoy doing it well. "I'm trying to accept myself for who I am," she said. "One of the reasons track was so important to me is my size, how big I am. When I was working out, even though I'd get bigger, I felt immune to how people looked at me. I want that confidence." She had started dating again. So is Kat's story a cautionary tale? Is it what every parent with a career plan fears? On one hand, she had to give up her dream, twice. On the other hand, she found being a mother incredibly rewarding despite the sacrifices, not to mention having to raise Marlena without a husband. I tell Kat's story here because it reflects the ambiguity I found in the whole of my research. Kat was philosophical now. "I think of Marlena as the greatest gift. It's not for me to criticize or change the nature of this gift. It's like when you witness a miracle. My job is to accept it, as it is, whatever it brings." I thought that was wise, and I remember it when I get stressed out about having less time for my own needs. That's pretty much how I got over the mental hurdle, by learning to give up control and accept whatever kind of gift I would receive. My wife, Michelle, had always wanted children and was vocal about it. I was never sure. One day, she put it in different terms. She said, "I've been on the pill since before I ever had sex. I'm tired of preventing my body from doing what it does naturally. I want to stop not having a baby. If it takes years, that's okay." Those words changed me. I saw my life on different terms. It wasn't my freedom I'd been protecting, it was my monopoly over life. I was a control freak masquerading as a bon vivant, and that's not who I wanted to be. So I decided to let nature take its course. That's still how I think of it. We have very little plan. We'll find out. Huge numbers of young people are choosing to never have kids. Now that I am on the other side of that choice, it makes me sad. But I have no doubt why they've opted out. Becoming a parent is routinely characterized by new parents as a life-changing event. It's played up to be a significant break from what was. If I ever mentioned I was considering becoming a parent to someone who already was a parent, they eyed me sternly and played God for a moment and delivered a clear warning. "Your life's going to change. For good and bad," they would imply, "but say goodbye to who you used to be," was their point. It came across as a threat. Anyone who enjoys their life would wonder, "Geez, I'm already happy. Do I want to screw it up?" I can't tell you how much it helped when one of my Hollywood producers, a father of three, leveled with me. He said, "In the fall, on Sundays, you can't watch all four quarters of the football game. You catch a few plays and watch SportsCenter after they've gone to bed. Otherwise, life goes on." On the television show, most of the other writers had babies or toddlers. We still had a blast. This was eye-opening. Does your life change? Sure. Do you make sacrifices? Absolutely. But nature takes care of us. We get 9 months to prepare. For the first half year of babies' lives, they only need love and milk. They sleep more than they're awake. You have time to get accustomed to these rhythms. Life changes significantly but at a pace we're built to handle. In the same way women have the hormones that loosen the hip ligaments in order to let a baby move through that canal, we have the psychiatric makeup to adjust to being a parent. Not everyone, but most. People have managed to raise kids since the beginning of time. Most of the great men and women from history had kids. The notion that your career success hinges on being child-free is overplayed. If you need to wait, that's legit. If you don't ever want to be a parent, fine. But telling yourself it's for your career is not a fact, it's a fear. When I was in New Orleans, one young man who was not yet a parent, but considering it, said, "I've noticed that people who don't have kids never quite see themselves as a success, and people who do have kids never see themselves as failures." It seemed dead true to me, but why? Are kids an achievement that makes you feel like a success? Not quite. I stared at his quote for 6 months before I could see the cause and effect. Having kids will teach you to be accepting. Not to be submissive, but to be patient, tolerant of minor delays. You don't measure yourself on the conventional success-failure spectrum. Many parents talk about how it's made them better people, and this is one of those ways. It forces the mind to be a little more flexible. Another benefit is that it teaches the joy of being generous. By giving so much to our kids, we become accustomed to how satisfying this is. We open ourselves up to a whole range of emotional rewards that we didn't give much credence to before. We find these rewards not only in our kids, but everywhere. When you put these gifts together and recognize them, you don't end up in the usual me or my child trade-off, sacrifice or be selfish. You discover that your child has given you a new outlook, maybe one that solves your permanent unease. This next story, of Rick Olson and his son Patrick, illustrates this beautifully.